Good afternoon. I will call to order this remote hearing of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Dockendorf to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon. Excuse. Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll, present.
Representative Barr.
Barr, here.
Representative Carlson.
I'm here.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Elkins, present.
Representative Haley.
Haley, present.
Representative Kegel.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee, present.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, present.
Representative Lucero.
Happy St. Patrick's Day Eve.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Farr, present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Tice.
Tice, present.
We have a quorum, and I appreciate the reminder, Representative Lucero. My daughter had threatened to pinch me, so that was very helpful. The first item on our agenda is approval of our minutes from yesterday, March 15th, 2022. Representative Kegel, do you have a motion? I guess not. Let's try Representative Dabney, only because his camera's on.
Ah, well, that's what I get. So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney moves approval of the minutes from March 15th, 2022. Any discussion to that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes from March 15th, 2022 are approved. Members, today we are hearing a series of bills related to our state's antitrust laws. Before we move into the bills, we're going to have opening testimony from our Attorney General, Keith Ellison. Attorney General Ellison.
Well, let me thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank all of the members for taking time to hear these really, really important bills. I would submit to you that fair competition is the backbone of markets and free enterprise. The system prevailing in the United States cannot operate properly unless there is fair competition. When markets don't have fair competition, costs go up for consumers, for workers. Barriers to entry go up for new entrants who may have innovative ideas. Also, quality, choice, and innovation go down. Fair competition extends not only to the sale of products, but also to buyers and labor markets. Consolidation of markets, consolidated markets, and decreased competition make it harder for all Minnesotans to afford their lives and live with dignity, safety, and respect. Fair market, on the other hand, help everyone in our economy do better. Market dominance does harm consumers. Corporate consolidation combined with lower wages costs American households up to $5,000 a year in lost purchasing power. More and more studies every day are showing that market dominance also causes declining competition that stifles innovation and prevents new startup competitors from emerging. For example, between 1978 and 2012, the number of companies of less than 1 year old dropped 44%. And in all 50 states, the number of firm closures continue to outpace new firm founded formations. We need new companies. That means new ideas, new dreams, getting a shot in the marketplace. Market concentration hurts wages, too. When it goes up, employees' wages go down. One study found that the median annual compensation would be more than $10,000 higher if employers were less concentrated. Ensuring that federal and state governments have and utilize antitrust tools would help us ensure a fair, competitive economy, and that, of course, is among my top priorities. We have, because of your help, increased our antitrust group, and we need some updated tools to be even more effective at the work you all are helping us do. This is particularly true in industries in which we have seen some of the highest and largest increase in market concentration and consolidation. Agriculture, big tech, and healthcare. Let's talk about agriculture for a minute. Former U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue in 2019 said, in America, the big get better, bigger, and the small go out. The big get bigger, and the small go out. Well, quite honestly, that's quite the opposite of what the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act and other antitrust legislation requires. In fact, when the big get too big, they get too big to fail, which means that ultimately is the taxpayer problem. In fact, small players in the market who have to compete on price and quality is really what American economic competition is all about. You could say it's the very idea of Americanism. Decades, however, of market consolidation has meant that today, 70 to 80% of pork packers are controlled by just four companies. 85% of the beef market is controlled by four companies. And 90% of the global grain trade is controlled by four companies. This is not good. Half of chicken farmers work in regions controlled by just one or two processing companies. Same story for hog producers. And prices have also skyrocketed in similarly concentrated fertilizer and pesticide markets. Recently, a farmer in Rice County shared a story with me that I'm hearing more and more. When the farmer puts their livestock up for auction, there have been only two buyers. The limited number of buyers impacts the value that they can get for their livestock, and they worry that the next time they go to auction, there might be only one buyer or no buyer, resulting in significant losses for their farm. But it's not just agriculture, although my office believes we need to concentrate our efforts in agriculture. We also see big tech. In big tech, we have seen companies like Facebook buy up their potential rivals like Instagram and WhatsApp before they become a threat. And companies like Apple and Google require app developers to use a specific app store or in-app payment system. In fact, another bill being heard today, House File 1184 by Representative Wolgamott, which I also support, would prohibit app stores from requiring app developers to use a specific app store in a specific payment system. This anti-competitive practice is particularly harmful in an area that could see so much more innovation and growth, but for this practice. And of course, healthcare. We've got to talk about healthcare. Consolidation in healthcare, whether drug manufacturers merging with each other or other drug manufacturers, or pharmacies and pharmacy benefit managers merging with insurance companies, or claims processors merging with claims processors, is a major driver of higher prices, less choice, lower quality in healthcare. The Department of Justice and the FTC use an index to measure market concentration. Using that index, the Healthcare Cost Institute issued a report that concluded that by 2016, almost 75% of U.S. hospital markets were at that point designated highly concentrated, meaning minimal competition. Meaning, if you don't, you can take or leave what we're offering, but that's all you're ever going to find around here. That's the reality. The award-winning report of my advisory task force on lowering pharmaceutical drug prices, which I commend to all of you, shed a lot of light on the impact of consolidation in this industry. But it is happening in other sectors of healthcare as well, including primary care and insurance. Consolidation in any market, but particularly in agriculture, big tech, and healthcare, makes it that much more possible for corporations to abuse their market power to maintain or improve profits and to leave consumers with higher prices, lower quality, and less choice. This means that the same farmer in Rice County I mentioned before faces even more limited choices on healthcare providers and pharmacists in their area, all at a higher cost. Neither federal or state antitrust laws have kept up with these new and rapidly changed markets. Just as Congress is considering how to modify existing federal antitrust statutes on a bipartisan basis, I may add, and I would know since I served 12 years in Congress, Minnesota should do the same for antitrust law at the state level. To that end, the Minnesota Attorney General's office supports a series of bills that you're going to hear about today, and these bills update and improve Minnesota's antitrust law to better respond to and address current industries and markets. And these proposals, if adopted, will make all of us better off. And we'll be better off because of fair competition, better products, better prices, not predatory pricing and unfair arrangements that are uncompetitive. Let me give you a brief overview of how my office analyzes these bills. First, House File 4143, Monopoly and Monopsony Power Regulated. I'll start with the first bill. This is by Representative Elkins, and I want to thank Representative Elkins for his excellent work. This bill would be to update existing Minnesota antitrust statutes. Because this bill, in its wisdom, recognizes the power by defining monopoly and monopsony so that we can have some legal standards that are enforceable. Monopoly power effectively eliminates economic competition for producing a particular good or providing a particular service. It can prevent other companies from entering the market. The consequence of unchecked monopoly power is that prices are higher for consumers than they would be in a competitive market. But not only that, choice is limited, wages are usually lower, market entrants are usually facing higher barriers. The Minnesota Antitrust Statute of 1971 finds abuse of monopoly power illegal, but it does not define what monopoly power is. This critical legislation would help us do that. Rather than allow judges to define what a legislature meant to include as monopoly power, I believe the Minnesota State Legislature has the power to tell them. The legislature could, and I believe should, provide clarity and guidance for businesses, enforcers, and judges who weigh the evidence and determine whether a violation has occurred. As all of you know very well, a clear standard actually helps businesses who want to respect antitrust statutes. But if they have a clear boundary, they will know what's all right and what's not. And that would do a lot of good for the players in the market who believe that following the rule of law is the right thing. The same goes for monopsony power, which is not as well known, but is just as harmful. Monopsony power occurs when entities are the only buyer and they're in a position to position themselves as the only few purchasers of a particular good or service. Abuse of monopsony power has most recently been examined thoroughly in labor markets where workers have had few employers to choose from. Monopsony power used inappropriately in a labor market hurts workers because they get paid less than they would if they were actually working in a competitive labor market. While we can and do work with and encourage our federal partners, state antitrust enforcers need improved tools. And I would simply submit to you that even though we believe that our federal partners are helpful, critical, and essential to this work, they often move slower. States can move quicker. And I think the state of Minnesota is in a position to really help lead the way toward more competitive, more fair markets. The next bill is House File 4142, known as the Commercial Transaction Price Discrimination Prohibited Bill. This second bill, also by Representative Elkins, strengthens our state statute on price discrimination. The supply chain issues that the country has faced following COVID-19 pandemic have exposed significant challenges, especially for small and medium-sized businesses who may be at a disadvantage in their position with suppliers. given their small and volume needs. Dominant companies can take advantage of their market power and position to discriminate locally on price, product, and services. When they do that in an anti-competitive way to remove or reduce specific local competition, it hurts not only consumers in the community, but the community at large, which is in which this predatory practice is happening. This could be happening to that small independent grocery store, pharmacist, retail boutique, convenience store, or farmer. This bill would expand the type of price discrimination that would be unlawful in Minnesota, and it would mirror that of the Robinson-Patman Act so that the Minnesota businesses and consumers can better protect themselves from these predatory practices. The House File 4144, third bill, is by Representative Zach Stevenson. I want to thank you, Representative, for your work. And this bill goes to the heart of so many current antitrust issues. It makes abuse of a dominant market position an antitrust violation. I've been saying for a long time that monopoly power is one of the biggest challenges facing maintaining fair and competitive markets and avoid harm to consumers. If a company makes a better product or does things more efficiently, that company deserves success. But many companies that grew by building a better product are now trying to unfairly rig the system so that nobody else can ever compete with them. They climbed up the ladder and got on the roof, and now they want to pull it up. That's not fair. House File 4144 will give Minnesota the tools to prevent these abusive practices in the future and make sure that the next innovative idea gets a shot. As an example, in the world of online advertising, there are three sides to every transaction: a website that wants to sell ad space, an advertiser that wants to buy that ad space, and an intermediary program that helps buyers and sellers find each other and set a fair price. Google owns the dominant software for all three of these things. To quote one of the lawsuits against Google, Google is the pitcher, the batter, and the umpire. With this power, Google makes sure that advertisers using Google software have a leg up. The theoretically neutral intermediary software that Google owns will in fact preference Google clients when buying and selling ad space. This is just one of the examples of how House File 4144 will prevent dominant companies from abusing their power. So let me wrap up and thank you for giving me the time. This is one of the most important issues of our time. It is the key to a fair economy. It is the key to opportunity and the American dream. To start your business and compete, grow your idea, all you got to do is compete and work hard, unless the markets are not competitive and stacked against you. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your time. Respectfully, now is the time to act on improving and updating Minnesota antitrust statutes. This is a bipartisan issue. All of us care about fair markets so that antitrust enforcers can better fight for fair markets across Minnesota and protect Minnesota businesses and consumers from the effects of exclusionary, anti-competitive behavior. And now I'm done, and I thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, Mr. Attorney General, for joining us today, and more importantly, for your leadership and work on antitrust issues over many, many years, both when you were in the Congress and now as Attorney General. I know your office is involved in litigation to protect Minnesota's consumers on a variety of fronts, and I know that this cause is very important. You've been working very hard on it, and I appreciate the work that we've been able to do together to develop this legislation, and your office's cooperation is absolutely essential. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Talk to you soon.
Talk soon. We also have Mr. Gary Wordish from the Farmers Union, who's going to talk before we get into the bills in specific. Mr. Wordish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee members for taking my testimony. I'm Gary Wordish, president of the Minnesota Farmers Union, and I live in western Minnesota, and I assist my son on his farming operation. I just want to reinforce the Attorney General did an excellent job explaining the importance of these bills, and I'll just go back to a little bit kind of my history, or the, you know, as we got into COVID-19 now 2 years ago, I guess, it really exposed the problems we have within the beef packing industry. At that time, when the plants had to shut down to the workers getting sick from the virus, and yet we've heard reports of the meat packers making as much as $1,800 a head profit on the beef on every animal they process, and a farmer or rancher sometime were selling that animal at a loss. That's what is wrong. That's what market domination can do. That's what consolidation in the marketplace can do. Not only that farmer took a loss on that animal or possibly took a loss on an animal, but it affected the consumers too. It ended up at higher price meat than the consumer. You know, so the consumer was paying a price, the farmer was paying a price, and you see it retail back to, as that's over the years, consolidation in the market power has caused a lot of farmers to have to leave the farm. You know, and it's caused a lot of small businesses to also not have their business on Main Street. So as they exit, you have that many less people going to town buying products from their local hardware store, sending their children to schools, supporting their hospitals. So it's really had a dramatic effect. You know, I go back one time, you know, you still see various empty farm sites. As you go through a lot of small towns, you see a lot of small towns boarded up, a lot of businesses that at one time were thriving businesses. As the market power has definitely had an influence on that. My own particular community of Renville, at one time we had two thriving hardware stores, did a very good business. Right now we have zero. We still have a grocery store, but you know they're struggling. And that's just one community. You see that throughout rural America. That's the importance of doing work, what we can. You know, a lot of this goes back to antitrust laws at the federal level that have passed, but we've been lax in enforcing them. The Attorney General, during with the emergency powers that the governor had at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a large Minnesota egg company that was taking advantage of the profit or taking advantage of the marketplace and significantly increased the price of what they were selling their eggs for. They didn't increase the price what they were selling their individual farmers to, but they increased it so what the consumer is paying. The governor the Attorney General, through the powers that he had with the governor's emergency orders at that time, was able to correct that. He took them to court and he won that and they reversed. Right now, he doesn't have that ability to do that. If there's somebody out there through their market power wants to take advantage of a market situation, the Attorney General doesn't have the ability to stop that. That's the importance of getting this done, getting these bills passed as Farmers Union. So I want to express the appreciation of hearing a testimony and the importance of passing these antitrust bills.
Thank you, Mr. Wordish. We will now take up the first of the bills. That's House File 4143 by Representative Elkins. Representative Elkins, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Representative Elkins moves House File 4143 be laid over. And Representative Elkins, you have an author's amendment.
I do. I have a author's amendment labeled DE2. And I should explain that briefly. Last night there was a DE1 posted, which has been taken down, replaced with this one. And the difference between the DE1, for anyone who saw it, and this one is that in the DE2, there is some changes to the proposed penalties in the DE2. These proposed state penalties are tied to the corresponding penalties in federal law and set at about 25% of the corresponding federal penalty. Otherwise, the DE1, if anyone saw it, is the same as the DE2. So I will move the DE2 amendment.
Representative Elkins moves the DE2 amendment. Any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the DE2 is adopted. Representative Elkins, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Attorney General Ellison explained so eloquently, 4142 primarily does two things. First of all, it updates the definition of what constitutes monopoly power, and then it adds a definition of what was referred to as monopsony power. So everyone knows what monopoly power is. That's when you have a single seller of a product who was able to take advantage of their monopoly power to exact higher prices or more favorable conditions. Monopsony is a term that was coined by economists to describe the phenomenon of a monopoly buyer. And the prime example of that has already been discussed by Mr. Wordish and the Attorney General, the case where we have It's seen extreme consolidation in the meatpacking industry, such that in some areas of Minnesota, a hog farmer or a rancher, other agricultural producer may only have one buyer who's bidding on their products. And so they're basically being, tendered take it or leave it offers, which is, severely damaging to Minnesota agricultural businesses. So this is pretty straightforward. I think the language that has been drafted by the Attorney General staff clarifies, provides very clear definitions of these terms, includes monopsony. And I would say that also add that most economists and people who study antitrust law would believe that monopsony abuses are already covered under the current monopoly laws, but there has been quibbling about that issue lately. And so this clarifies, makes it very explicit that, that our antitrust laws will cover both monopoly and monopsony power. So, Mr. Chair, we have a testifier, Elizabeth Odette, Assistant Attorney General, and then also Zach Bezans, another Assistant Attorney General, will be available for questioning as well.
Wonderful. Yes, I have Ms. Odette on my list first. Assistant Attorney General Elizabeth Odette.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Elizabeth Odette, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Minnesota Attorney General's Office in the Antitrust Division. I joined the Antitrust Division of the office about 2 years ago after working in private practice for over 15 years with a focus on antitrust. The bill before you today is, as Representative Elkins mentioned, it's a delete all amendment of the initially proposed House File 4143 because the number of changes made it more readable to just do a delete all, but it isn't entirely new language. As the Attorney General and Representative Elkins explained, a significant threat to fair markets in today's economy is the rise of monopoly and monopsony power. Both compliance and enforcement are more efficient when the rules are clear. Minnesota Statute 325D.52 currently provides that the use or attempted use of monopoly power for the purpose of affecting competition or controlling, fixing, or maintaining prices is unlawful. But each company setting its antitrust compliance policies and each court that is presented with allegations and evidence needs to individually determine what they believe to be the correct definition of monopoly power. This bill eliminates that uncertainty by defining monopoly power as a seller's power to control prices, control market supply, or exclude or suppress competition, and then provides examples of each. And as the Attorney General and Representative Elkins explained, that the flip side of monopoly power is monopsony power, essentially a buyer-side monopoly. That could be just as harmful. Yet the Minnesota antitrust statute currently doesn't specifically address monopsony power. This bill cures this by not only defining monopsony power as a buyer's power to control prices, including wages, to control market demand, or exclude or suppress competition for input, and then provide examples, it also expressly includes monopsony power in the following pre-existing parts of the Act: the scope of the Act, which is at 325D.54, and 325D.52, which finds unlawful the establishment, maintenance, or use of monopoly power, and then adding or monopsony power. In Minnesota Statute 325D.51, which has a contract combination or conspiracy between two or more persons in unreasonable restraint being unlawful, this bill would make an attempt to do so also unlawful. This would align with federal law that generally prohibits invitations to collude. This bill also adds language to reduce the abuse and overuse of the pro-competitive effects defense, which requires expensive expert analysis to rebut potential justifications for an alleged anti-competitive action. This bill reins in the use of this defense, but does not eliminate it completely, providing that evidence of non-pretextual or legitimate competitive benefits may be a defense only when such benefits significantly outweigh the competitive harm. This bill also removes in competition, the language in competition, from Minnesota Statute 325D.53, Subdivision Part 1, to address all collusion, even when the agreement hurts just one of the parties to the agreement. And then in Part 2 of that same subdivision, it removes the word public, because that would ensure that private solicitations for bids that engage in the detailed anti-competitive practices therein would similarly be protected as are public contracts right now. And then finally, civil penalties. Civil penalties in Minnesota's antitrust statutes have not kept up with inflation or corporate profits. Federal antitrust statutory penalties better reflect the realities of the current markets. And it would hopefully, by increasing the civil penalties, it would hopefully deter worst case scenario, punish a wrongdoer, and then warn potential offenders that violate the antitrust statutes that harm Minnesota businesses and consumers. And it would demonstrate that doing so would be a costly endeavor for a company. This bill provides that a civil penalty, which would ultimately be determined by a court, and any recovery would go straight to the State of Minnesota General Fund, be no more than $250,000 per violation for an individual and not more than $25 million per violation for any other person, which under statute would mean an organization. It would also then double that civil penalty if an individual or entity failed to comply with a final judgment. These amounts are only 25% of the current penalties, as Representative Elkins mentioned, that can be imposed under federal law. And then including the per violation language clarifies that the penalty could be assessed on individual actions as ultimately determined by a court, rather than the possibility that only one civil penalty could be assessed for an overarching anti-competitive scheme that lasts years. And then finally in this bill, this section, in this criminal penalties, there's a change so that they would align with the civil penalties. Mr. Chair, members, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Odette. We also have a testifier, Brad Kluver. Mr. Kluver.
Hi, good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brad Kluver. Want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today regarding the antitrust regulations. Currently, my family raises corn, soybeans, and hogs on our farm just south of the Twin Cities. We've seen considerable consolidation, and there continues to be consolidation in the ag sector. When looking at selling livestock, there used to be a well-established cash market. We were able to sell hogs through the stockyards up in St. Paul or auction barns like down in Zimbrota. But in today's climate, most family farms are reliant on selling through very limited channels. And we saw this especially going through COVID. My family, where we sell our pigs to, we actually got shut off for a considerable period of time, and we're facing some really challenging options moving forward. But by having more consolidation in the industry, we just don't have quite as many processors that we're able to sell through. Where I farm, there's essentially three different companies that I would have the opportunity to sell my pigs to. But in some cases, it gets to be a couple hundred miles away. So the diversity of markets that farmers are able to sell their livestock through has narrowed considerably over the past couple decades. Having a robust cash or negotiated market is imperative to my farm and the profitability of farm families like mine moving forward. As we look at farms and profitability, despite raising more livestock, the margin per animal continues to narrow every year. And by having more consolidation on the buying side, it leads to less opportunity to negotiate that cash price on the hogs that I raise. We've also seen this past year on fertilizer and our inputs on the crop side. I have a couple different cooperatives or distributors that I can purchase fertilizer, my fertilizer needs from. But it's incredibly limited on the supplier side on where they're sourcing fertilizer from. There's obviously been numerous factors that have come into play over the last year on what's happening in all the markets, but we've seen fertilizer prices triple in some cases compared to prices we paid just a year ago to get our crop in the ground. By having such a limited number of companies to work through on purchasing fertilizer, it provides less opportunity to negotiate that price to establish a fair market. As a farmer, both seller power and buyer power impact my operation. So I'm glad to see this proposal to make sure both are adequately defined in law. As we look at the scope and scale of companies that families like mine purchase or sell through, many of them are multinational companies that span far beyond southern Minnesota. The fines levied against them, against any companies found to be in violation of antitrust laws, need to be commensurate Otherwise, they can be seen simply as the cost of doing business. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Mr. Kluver. We now will have some public testimony. The first public testifier is Beth Cadoon. Ms. Cadoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Beth Cadoon with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We represent 6,300 businesses of all sizes in industries employing over 500,000 Minnesotans. The Minnesota Chamber advocates for a strong business climate in order to help facilitate a strong, competitive, and growing economy. To respect the committee's time, I'll provide overarching comments on all three of these antitrust bills and then provide some specifics to each bill as was requested by the committee. So you'll be hearing from me a couple times today. There's also a joint letter that was posted from the Minnesota Chamber and other business associations, including NFIB, Minnesota Business Partnership, Minnesota Grocers, Medical Alley, Minnesota Retailers, and then MIFSC, expressing their oppositions to this bill, these bills, and outlining some additional concerns. The Minnesota Chamber supports a vibrant, competitive private sector marketplace, as well as the enforcement of current antitrust laws in order to help ensure vigorous competition for the benefit of the consumer. So we're similar to the Attorney General with that goal. However, we do differ greatly from the Attorney General's comment on the impact of these bills. We are opposed to these three bills as they represent a misguided expansion of Minnesota's antitrust laws that would be damaging to our economy and business climate. If enacted, Minnesota would become an outlier as we would go beyond both federal antitrust laws as well as the competition in any other state. The result will be great uncertainty for businesses and open the door to unnecessary litigation on a wide range of business practices that benefit consumers. It's important to remember that one of the central tenets of our current antitrust laws is the protection of competition, not competitors. In market economies, competition between firms necessarily produces winners and losers, and it does help drive innovation and efficiencies. This competition ultimately benefits consumers, and it's that benefit to consumers that seem to be lost in the law changes that we see in these proposals. Specific to this bill, we are opposed to this bill. I did not see that new amendment that Representative Elkins highlighted, so we were basing our comments on the previous amendment that was just posted, which does seem to greatly increase both civil and criminal penalties, as mentioned. It does introduce new ambiguous language and expands Minnesota's antitrust state laws above federal laws and other states, and we believe greatly enhances litigation risks and exposure for Minnesota businesses. Specifically, it introduces some language regarding the non-pretextual competitive benefits that's mentioned in this bill. And it appears this will have a negative impact on the current review by the courts to determine antitrust violations that use the current consumer welfare standard. This standard is used to determine harm to competition. Extensive case law shows that the consumer welfare standard considers a host of factors beyond price, including quality, variety, service, and innovation. Antitrust violations are only found when a plaintiff proves that the consumer welfare is harmed as a result of the pro-competitive effects being outweighed by the anti-competitive effects. And that was just mentioned in testimony that they're looking to limit the look at those pro-consumer benefits. Without such an economic balancing test by the courts, are left without a legal framework to determine violations, and any attempt to change the law to only measure one side of the ledger has the great potential for government usurping the role of consumers, picking winners and losers in our marketplace. Our analysis of the newly amended language with the new definitions of monopoly and monopsony do not follow federal case law in the analysis that was just done on the new amendments. Like I said, they were newly posted, so we're certainly still looking these over. The terms like abuse of power are efforts to shortcut, in our view, the current economic analysis by the courts that help determine if the actions of the firm harm competition through that consumer welfare standard that I mentioned. Antitrust is not focused on market share, rather it is focused on conduct and whether that conduct, regardless of the size of the firm and the market, results in harm to consumers. As I mentioned, we're concerned as this bill greatly expands civil and criminal penalties, and we see this being as especially problematic when you include terms and language that are unclear and above federal law so that businesses will not necessarily have a clear understanding of the pricing decisions and business decisions that might result in triggering these penalties. So thank you for allowing me to testify, and we urge your opposition to this bill.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Chris Marchese from NetChoice. Mr. Marchese.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Chris Marchese, and I'm counsel for NetChoice. We are a trade association based in D.C., and our members include tech businesses of all sizes, so the usual suspects like Google, Facebook, Amazon, as well as smaller or medium-sized platforms like eBay, Etsy, and Pinterest. I'm going to be opposing the whole host of antitrust bills, but I think to keep the analysis kind of simple, I'll just focus on the one bill before us right now. And on that, you know, honestly, I want to commend the sponsor and the committee for amending the legislation over the past 24 hours. In our original comments, we pointed out that some of the definitions needed reworking and that the evidentiary provision about pro-competitive effects needed changing. So I'm very happy to see that those edits were made. But unfortunately, I think further changes are necessary before you all vote on this. And that's what I'm going to just focus on super quickly. As was alluded to in Beth's testimony, you know, the courts always look at actual effects. You know, what are businesses really doing in the marketplace? Are they actually benefiting consumers, or are they hurting consumers? And there is an emphasis on looking at the fact that sometimes certain conduct actually hurts competitors, but helps consumers. We see this all the time. For example, in, you know, the tech industry, we see complaints about the fact that Amazon is able to reduce prices on many goods. You know, people don't like the fact that Amazon is able to offer better deals than, you know, some more traditional marketplaces. But the fact is that competition is incredibly good for consumers, even if it puts extra competitive pressure on traditional brick and mortar retailers. So at the end of the day, what we want to ensure the courts are able to do is to take a realistic look at market realities and to really get to the bottom of whether something is going to be to the benefit of consumers or going to be to their detriment. And the only way that can happen is if the courts don't have to make arbitrary factual or legal findings on things such as significantly outweighs. I mean, I understand that, you know, the law is filled with these qualifying terms. But by introducing this new language that the pro-competitive effects must significantly outweigh the anti-competitive effects, you're now introducing a whole nother task for judges and for defendants and for the government, as well as private plaintiffs, to litigate. I think it should be, or rather, the state would be better served by following the federal standards that have been in place for decades. And it should simply be, you know, a harmonization between federal and state law on that point. So other than, you know, this new language about the significantly outweighs, I think that the bill is heading in a better direction. I am very happy to see the changes with some of the definitions. And while NetChoice opposes the legislation in its current batch, you know, we always stand ready to work with anyone to amend it to a better place. Thank you.
Thank you. This concludes public testimony on the bill, so we'll now move to member questions and discussions. Any members wishing to speak to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Elkins, any closing comments?
We've had a good discussion on this one. I think it's pretty straightforward. The bill as drafted by the AG's office is very well written, in my opinion, and I urge members to vote yes.
When we do vote, which yes. Will not be today. But
that's right, yes. Darn. I had you.
Representative O'Driscoll, I don't know if you had a question about that comment before we...
Oh, no, Mr. Chair, I was just looking at some notes and you went kind of quickly through questions, and I do have just a couple of questions if you don't mind.
Certainly go. I'm sorry if I moved too quickly there. I thought I had a nice deliberative pause, but...
Yeah, well, we don't have a list of who the testifiers are, so we don't know, you know, how many folks there are going to be. So
I like to keep you on your toes. Go ahead. Representative O'Driscoll,
I appreciate that. To the bill author, I've got some questions about, and again, in the DE amendment, line 1.7, you have the words profitable raise prices, and substantially above the competitive level. I'm just wondering if we have definitions of those, or where would we get the definition of those two words of profitability and substantially, if we were to this were to become law, what would be our guiding source on that? Because the bill doesn't have a definition section or parameter as to how to define that.
Representative Elkins, and of course, if you'd like to refer that question to Ms. Odette or
Ms. Yeah, I'll Odette. Defer that question to Ms. Odette.
Ms. Odette?
Could you point me to the line and page again of where you're speaking?
Sure, absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. It's line 1.7, I believe, in the DE amendment that references profitability and substantiability.
I'll refer to my colleague, Mr. Bizons, to answer that.
Mr. Bizons.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just to very quickly introduce myself. I joined the office just this year as part of the expansion of our antitrust unit. I've investigated and litigated antitrust matters in both the private and public sector over the last 13 years. Representative, your question is in two parts, and so I'll try to address them part by part. As to what the word profitably means, it is best defined in context. Normally, when a company raises its prices, we would expect it to lose market share and therefore lose some of its profits in a competitive environment. Same with if it reduces its output or degrades its product quality. In a market where a company has market power, it may profitably be able to make those changes, such that it can raise prices. It may lose some business, but it will not lose so much business that its profits would decline due to the conduct. So profitably is a modifier on all of these types of actions and is ways to express market power. Your other question was, I'm sorry, Representative, could you tell me your other question again?
Substantially above, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Substantially above competitive level. I'm not sure what that means. And again, no definition section in the bill. So I'm just kind of wonder where we're going to get the definition, how we're going to use this as a measuring stick.
Mr. Bizons.
That, I think, is largely to the discretion of the courts, but there's substantially above the competitive level is, I mean, you can break it down into a couple of different parts. Competitive level, that's economics. That's what we bring in expert witnesses to testify about the economic realities. We can often do in antitrust litigation case studies against when a market was in a more competitive dynamic versus a less competitive dynamic. There are many tools in the field of economics to determine what a competitive level is. The question of what is substantially above the competitive level is going to vary from industry to industry. And that's why we leave that to the discretion of the courts.
I just add that we have lots of cases like that, of terms like that in the law. You know, when we say something is a reasonable conduct, for example, we don't define out what reasonable is in every situation. That's why you might have litigation to determine whether something is reasonable or substantially above. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a quick comment and then one other quick question, because I know that we've got a number of bills we want to get through today. The Attorney General, in his opening comments, strongly underscored the fact that the legislature should be making these decisions and not the courts. I just thought I would point that out as something that struck me in his comments today. Secondly, the fines seem to be kind of aggressive and excessive in here. They're going to be uniformly applied to large multinational corporations and the small mom and pop shop if they happen to be someone who gets caught in the snare of this. Is there going to be a tiering on this, or are we just going to kind of have small businesses that they can't afford the large fines be just dissolved, go out of business, become insolvent? What's the future look like for those folks?
Representative Owens.
I'll defer that one to Ms. Odette and Mr. Bizons as well.
Ms. Odette?
Yes, I can answer that one. So the language in there keeps in the up to or not more than. And so when a court is looking at the facts of the case, and we would assume that one of the determinations, and it's determination of what an appropriate civil penalty would be, is to look at the size of the company, the size of its profits, maybe annual, that would be the way that this language would prevent a civil penalty to be inappropriate. It would just be not more than, so that it would allow a court, if a company is of a large size, to have an appropriately proportional civil penalty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's difficult today in such a short committee hearing time to go through these very, very complex bills. So I just wanted to make a statement that I think this needs a lot more work. Certainly, we all want to have free and competitive marketplace and prevent unfair discrimination. But I'm concerned that these bills have an undue litigation risk to them. We are in a time where businesses are facing so much uncertainty, supply chain issues, in addition to double-digit increases in their unemployment insurance tax rates, because we have not been able to get past that significant priority yet. I have read through the bills, but this is complex policy, and I don't. I guess my overall understanding of antitrust is that it's not focused on market share, but it's focused on the conduct and whether that conduct, regardless of the size of the firm, results in harm to consumers. In addition to what Representative O'Driscoll said, I feel like these penalties are very large and aren't, you know, sized right for small businesses, and actually will do harm to our businesses and harm to innovation in our state, versus actually, you know, reducing prices for consumers. So just wanted to make those comments, and I know we have a half hour left, so I think these bills really need a lot more time, Mr. Chair, for full vetting and full understanding. Thanks for the opportunity to make some comments.
Well, and thank you, Representative Haley, and we are laying over this bill. We are laying over the other bills on the agenda today. So the idea is to have a conversation today, but we will not be voting on these bills today, so that will give us more opportunity to take into account the fact that these are very important subjects and very complex. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to underscore some of those same points, that as the legislative body, I am not comfortable passing a bill, and I know you just said we're not voting on it today, but in the future, passing a bill with excessive levels of terms of reasonable, in just what we've heard, and deferring, and then the answers I continue to hear from the bill author and from the testifiers are, we'll just leave that up to the courts to determine. Well, you know what? We are the legislative branch. We have an opportunity and an obligation to determine that now, not deferring that to a legislative, or I'm sorry, to a judicial branch. One of the industries that I'm most familiar with is obviously real estate. And so if we are to defer to, quote unquote, some experts or to the judicial branch to determine what an excessive amount of profit is, well, we need only look at, I mean, there are many examples we can use where government has determined and set arbitrary levels. We look at recent cities with their rent control not to exceed 3%, regardless of the inflationary pressures on the market. And so in this industry that I'm in, housing, real estate, rental, property management, the costs right now for small businesses in the property management business are rising faster than 3%. But when government comes in and just arbitrarily determines that 3% is the max rise, that's an example of where government is getting it wrong. And there are other forces, political forces at play. And I do not trust the legislative, us ourselves, determining this, let alone the judicial branch or any other quote-unquote expert. There's no expert in market forces, because when you have two willing parties that choose to engage in a voluntary transaction where one party has a maximum willingness to pay and one party has a minimum willingness to sell, and if they can negotiate, that's their business, not government to continue to interfere. So thank you.
Thanks, Representative Zero. I think I would encourage you to take a look at the Sherman Antitrust Act and some of the terms that are in there and how they've developed largely through judicial interpretation over years, which is kind of the model for this whole area. It's not something that you can spell out quite that way. But Representative Elkins, you've made some final comments before. We do have a couple other bills. I don't know if you want to say anything further. You're shaking your head no. So we'll just lay over House File 41-43, and we'll move to 41-42, Representative Elkins, would you like to move your bill?
I would like to move House File 4142.
Wonderful. And as people have been alluding to, we do have three bills, including this one, to get through today. So I ask everyone to try and keep their remarks concise as we move forward. Representative Elkins moves House File 4142 be laid over. Representative Elkins, to your bill.
Very quickly, the main thrust of this is to take longstanding federal law, basically the Robinson-Patman Act, which was passed in 1936. There are at least 20 other states that have state-level versions of the Robinson-Patman Act, which prohibits price discrimination, and that the primary goal here is to address instances of predatory pricing, and the Attorney General alluded to some of these, but a textbook example would be, say, a dollar store comes into a small town, establishes a store, slashes its product prices in order to put the local retailers out of business, and then as soon as the local retailers have been put out of business promptly, then raises the prices back up again. At this point, this is already illegal under longstanding federal law, but if we waited for the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission to pursue cases involving small town predatory pricing, we'd be waiting a long time. So this bill gives the AG's office explicit authority to pursue these cases of predatory pricing.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. We have some testifiers, some familiar faces here. Ms. Odette is first. Ms. Odette.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will just elaborate briefly on what Representative Elkins said. He gave the example of a company pricing a product below cost in one targeted location, but not in another, with a plan to recoup the loss elsewhere. Another example is price differences in the sale of identical goods in different locations that cannot be justified on the basis of cost savings to meet a competitor's price. So very similar to the example that he gave, but not having to price below cost, but still pricing low to try to target that one competitor in a local area. And then finally, another example is promotional allowances or services that are not practically available to all customers on proportionally equal terms. So if a toilet paper company has a favored customer, such as a large chain store, and it provides reimbursement for that toilet paper company to, in the form of discounts, to put a big display in the middle of their aisle, but asks an independent grocery store to do the same big display, but doesn't give them the same promotional allowances, then that would also be illegal under this bill. We support this bill so that antitrust enforcement in Minnesota can be expanded to all of these predatory actions. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Odette. Next is Ren Olive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Ren Olive. I use they, them pronouns, and I'm employed with the University of Minnesota Extension Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships. Part of my work has been to research challenges faced by rural grocery stores, identify needs, and connect those stores with available resources. Today, I want to share with you some of our research findings about rural grocery stores and competition. Rural grocery stores provide a public good. They are anchor businesses that offer a full range of fresh, frozen, and shelf-stable foods. Between 2019 and 2020, we conducted a mail survey of rural grocery stores in communities less than 2,500 people, which garnered a response rate of 55%. Nearly all of the 129 grocery stores who responded to our survey were independently owned small businesses located throughout Minnesota. One key theme that emerged from the survey was competition for food dollars. While 96% of rural grocers agree or somewhat agree that as a small business, they have a responsibility to the wider community, most are concerned about their store's economic sustainability. When asked to choose among a list of challenges after operating costs, competition with dollar stores was most frequently reported as the top challenge. 80% of rural grocery respondents reported a dollar store located within 15 miles of their store, and more than half of rural grocery stores had a dollar store move into their community within the past 5 years. Let me repeat that. Half of these independent grocery stores had a dollar store move into their community in the past 5 years. Now, grocers wrote comments about the impact of their dollar stores on their business. And one grocer stated, and I quote, "I lost over 30% the day the dollar store opened, and it has continued to take more and more business." Another grocer stated, quote, "As with most small town stores, we only get about 40% of the available business. If I were king, we grocers would pay the same wholesale price for goods." I want to reiterate what this grocer said. Grocers know that the wholesale prices for the same item is cheaper for a dollar store than for the exact same item from their grocery wholesaler. This grocer was not alone in these remarks. Another full-service independent grocery store reported that they were not able to purchase the same type and size products at the same price as are offered in the dollar store chains in the same community. While outside the scope of the survey, independent grocery wholesalers have informed us that they receive higher pricing at the food manufacturer for the same item going to a big box chain store. Food manufacturers, it appears, are basing their business model on low prices to big box stores and high prices to smaller independent stores. Independent stores are left in the dark on whether manufacturers are providing unfair advantages to preferred chain customers, or if the low cost pricing at the local chain store is specifically being targeted to run independents like them out of business. If you would like to learn more about the impact that independent rural grocery stores have on our state, I invite you to visit z.umn.edu/rural grocery report. I'm happy to address questions, and I thank you for your time today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I was just looking at the time and the list of testifiers and all the bills we have left, so I think we're going to have to start limiting testimony. We'll try to do 90 seconds. I just want to make sure that we get all the way through. As a reminder, we aren't voting today on these bills, so we would have another hearing if we move these bills forward. The next testifier is Chuck Lindner. Mr. Lindner.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and committee for listening. My name is Chuck Lindner. I live in War Road, Minnesota. I have a rural supermarket there, and I have one in Baudette, Minnesota, and Pine River, Minnesota. War Road, Minnesota is a town of about 1,800 people. We have a Dollar General that came in about 6 years ago, and then another one that came in about a year ago, right next to my supermarket. One of my vendors, like one of my pop vendors, came to me a little distraught and said, "The goal of Dollar General is to run you out of business, Chuck." I'm happy to report that hasn't happened. I've been able to innovate a little bit. But my frustration is some of the center store pricing that I compete with Dollar General on. In some cases, I can buy it cheaper from them at their retail price than I can buy from my wholesaler at wholesale cost. It's really impacted my center store sales, which is, you know, my core grocery. And I'm simply asking how can I get fair pricing so I can be competitive? We certainly operate on a different model, and Dollar Generals of the world don't necessarily, you know, donate to our communities. It's almost impossible to get a donation. I do, so there's a higher cost of goods, and I guess I accept that. So I'm ultimately asking how can I get that same cost that my competitor across the street can get. Certainly willing to answer any questions, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lindner. This is an example, I think, of how valuable Zoom can be in our remote, that you didn't have to drive down for that testimony. But really appreciate your perspective. Thank you. The next testifier is Beth Cadoon. Ms. Cadoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief, as was suggested. We're obviously very concerned over this bill as well. I urge your opposition to it. Although I know these bills are very well-intentioned, I think the impacts of them are going to be greatly increased litigation costs and, frankly, impact businesses all across the state. Businesses make pricing decisions every day, and this bill would prohibit many common business practices that are used actually to lower prices for consumers again. This law does go again beyond federal law and will create great uncertainty and legal exposure to businesses of all sizes all across the state. For example, nearly all sellers use different prices and use discounts. Many have programs with discounts for paying electronically or buying in bulk, or have loyalty programs as a means of competing in the marketplace. Under these bills, it's not clear if these current practices would be now unlawful. Another example is many of the vendors offer functional discounts, which is a difference in price to account for value of reseller services, such as a discount for warehousing the product or shipping the product or stocking the shelves. These are currently allowed as a pro-competitive defense under federal law, but would not be allowed under this bill. Businesses already are facing a lot of uncertainty as unknowns with supply challenges, rising inflation, workforce shortages, plus that UI trust fund deficit payroll tax increase that was just mentioned. This bill would once again enact substantial changes to antitrust laws dealing with pricing that would add even more uncertainty, litigation risk, and then regulatory burden. We would urge your opposition. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Next, we have Chris Marchese. Mr. Marchese.
Hi, everyone. I'm going to echo a lot of what Ms. Cadoon said. Basically, price discrimination is a common business practice. It's known as, you know, price differentials. But something that was said in the AG's testimony that I think is key here is that the state doesn't want to wait around for the feds to enforce the federal version of this. Well, I mean, if that's the case, then why not just have the state AG's office enforce the Robinson-Packman Act, have private parties enforce it? Enforcement doesn't lie solely with federal authorities. That being said, the reason why the federal government does not enforce price discrimination laws is because they hurt consumers. They grew out of a, you know, New Deal, Great Depression era thinking of trying to protect small locally owned businesses by preventing the big guys from being able to give discounts to consumers. That sounds like it's a good idea in theory, but it failed miserably in practice, because something to also remember are the small businesses that rely on those intermediaries for those price discounts, right? It's, you know, think about Target. Had this law been in effect and enforced, Target would never have been able to expand throughout the country, even though it delivers untold choice and lower prices for American consumers, which is significantly important for people, for low-income consumers and middle-class families who are struggling with inflation. So I ask that the committee shelve this legislation, or at the very least, if there is interest in enforcing some form of price discrimination, that they instead ask the AG's office to look at the federal law instead. Thank you.
Thank you. We will now move to member discussion and questions. Members, I ask you to be cognizant of the time and the fact that we're not voting today. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. You know, I spend a lot of time up in Cass County, and on my drive, there's probably a Dollar General every, I don't know, 2 miles, it seems like. But one thing I want to warn about is the fact that they don't have fresh produce at these stores. So if we're starving out our local grocery stores, we're creating food deserts. And so, you know, I just want us to be cognizant of that, because it's an hour drive from Longville to Brainerd. And there's a supermarket in Longville and a Dollar General, but the Dollar General does not have fresh produce. And so we need to make sure that we're not creating food deserts.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. Representative O'Driscoll.
Oops, there we go. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to just make a quick comment here and followed by a quick question as well. I thought that the toilet paper example was a very interesting example about setting up and rebating that may go on with that or incentive programs. One thing, folks, you got to keep in mind that if you are a large business, you will receive an extremely large break on your freight and on things that you purchase if you send your own vehicles, your own trucks, your own semis and trailers down to pick those things up. Mr. Lindner, as a smaller organization, doesn't really have that kind of mass to work with. He needs to have his things come on a truck that come from other areas. I understand that, but we're making it sound like because you're big, you're automatically bad, and I don't know that that's the case. A lot of these companies have employed the mantra of members on the other side of the aisle from me, $15 an hour, minimum $15 an hour and things. And these are the businesses that have stepped up, these larger companies, to do that. Why? Supply and demand in the marketplace. These businesses are going to know what they need to do in order to stay in business, and they want to be able to be viewed positively in the consuming market as well. Mr. Chair, my question is really to you. What's the future of these bills? We're laying them over. Are you planning on a separate antitrust omnibus bill, or is this going to go into the commerce bill? Just kind of curious as to what the future on these are.
Thanks, Representative Driscoll. No decision has been made yet.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, will members have a chance to do some additional follow-up and questions as well?
If we were ever going to move these bills forward, we would have time for members to answer questions.
Additional questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. That just helps us. And that doesn't mean we're not going to ask questions. It just means we'll be sparing in the questions we ask today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sarah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for the bill author. And Representative Elkins, in a hypothetical scenario here, that actually isn't hypothetical, it's very real. When it comes to building homes, sheets of OSB are obviously used, multiple sizes of timbers, 2x10s, 2x12s, 2x4s, 2x6s, shingles for roofing, all kinds of different material. When it comes to the supplier of OSB, for example, that's going to supply for a housing development from a national builder like Lennar or something that's going to build 1,000 homes in St. Michael versus a smaller home builder who might be building 10 homes because they're a significantly smaller builder. Would the supplier under your bill, would the supplier of the OSB to these two buyers, the national home builder Lennar versus a smaller home builder, would there be no opportunity for a price difference in the commodity of OSB sheets?
Representative Elkins.
Representative Lucero, I would imagine that that there could be volume discounts. I think that's what you're getting at. And I might defer this one to Ms. Odette just to see if this is the kind of thing that the AG's office would think about going after, but I wouldn't think so.
Ms. Odette?
That is correct. Volume discounts is not covered under this.
Representative Lucero, any brief follow-up?
Okay, well, I guess I mean, it's not brief, but in the future, and may not have an opportunity to. So I'd like to get a differentiation on how and why a volume discount is not covered in this bill and how that would be different from what is covered in this bill, because it's the sale of a commodity. And again, it needs a lot more scrutiny. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Lucero, I think you raise a fair question, and perhaps Ms. Odette, the Attorney General's Office, or Representative Elkins can respond to you in more detail offline. With that, Representative Elkins, do you have any closing comments?
No, we can move on to the next bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. We will renew your motion to have it laid over, and the bill is laid over. We only have 18 minutes left. I'm going to fall on my sword on my bill and postpone my bill probably to a different day. I very much apologize to the I think we have one or two testifiers who signed up just for this bill, and I apologize for that, but we are just running out of time, and I do want to get Representative Wolgamott's bill up because he's not a member of this committee. So we will move next to Representative Wolgamott's bill. I will move House File 1184 be laid over, and Representative Wolgamott, to your bill.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm here today to present House File 1184 because our mobile digital marketplace has a monopoly problem. Apple and Google have established themselves as the only two gatekeepers of the mobile internet. To reach consumers, all app developers must use Apple and Google's app stores. And both companies exploit their respective monopoly to take a 30% app tax, which creates barriers for small app developers, reduces competition, stifles innovation, and the biggest reason why I'm bringing this bill forward, Mr. Chair, is because it's driving up prices for consumers. So that's why we're presenting this bill. I'm bringing this bill forward today. The bill itself is pretty straightforward. The goal is to break up Apple and Google's app store monopolies and put small app developers and entrepreneurs and all of us who use our phones, use our apps to get around, to order food, to check the weather, to purchase things, to put all of us on an even playing field with these large companies. The bill itself, to the details of it, Mr. Chair, it's pretty simple. It prohibits an app store that has an annual cumulative gross receipts in excess of $10 million. It prohibits them from requiring a developer to use a specific app store as the exclusive mode of distribution for an app. And it prohibits them from requiring a developer to use an in-app payment system as the exclusive mode of accepting payments by users for downloading a software app or purchasing digital or physical products through an app. That's what the bill is, Mr. Chair. And a few more points I want to make about this. Apple's main slogan is there's an app for that. That's turned into, there's a tax for that. Again, charging developers of apps 30% to use their app stores and forcing them to use their in-app payment processing exclusively. And Apple and Google are using their monopoly power to line their pockets and rake in record profits, denying innovative app developers the ability to keep more of their revenue, which could be used to for further innovation, to invest in their products, to hire more workers, to increase competition amongst app developers, ultimately for the benefit of consumers, of Minnesotans. App developers who try to buck the system, who try to push back, who try to do other things, live in fear of Apple and Google and know that their existence depends on the whims of these two monopolies. The reality is that these gatekeepers can kick them out of the store at the push of a button and cut developers off from the businesses that they've worked so hard to create. So, Mr. Chair, I know we're short on time, and I know we've got a full list of testifiers, so I'll leave it at that. But ultimately, we're bringing this bill forward. We're standing up for app developers and innovation. We're standing up for Minnesotans. We're lowering the costs of digital marketplace by encouraging competition. That's why we're bringing this bill forward. With that, Mr. Chair, I know I've got three testifiers who can further shed light on the urgency of why we need to pass House File 1184.
Wonderful. And we do have a number of people who decided to testify. I'm going to have to ask them to limit their testimony to 1 minute each, with a reminder that the bill would, if before it moves, we'll bring it back. The first testifier is Rick Van Meter from the Coalition for App Fairness. Mr. Van Meter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rick Van Meter, and I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition for App Fairness, a nonprofit organization fighting for a fair marketplace for mobile app developers and consumers. We urge the passage of this legislation, which would simply give developers and consumers choice in app distribution and payment methods. Importantly, Apple already allows some apps to provide choice in payment methods and allows for the direct download of software on its Mac desktop and laptop computers. The dominant app platforms and the groups they fund oppose this bill and other efforts to inject competition into the mobile app market for the first time because they want to maintain their app store monopolies. So again, we urge you to approve this legislation so that app developers and users in Minnesota can benefit from a more fair mobile app marketplace. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van Meter. The next testifier is Shayad Naeem from the American Economic Liberties Project.
Thank you to the chair, vice chair, and members of the committee. My name is Shahid Naeem. I'm a policy analyst at the American Economic Liberties Project, an organization dedicated to reducing the power dominant corporations have over public life. We're here to express our strong support for HF 1184. Apple and Google have used predatory and abusive tactics to become dominant in app distribution. Just ask Congress's House Antitrust Subcommittee, which explained this in its historic report in 2020. These monopolists use their position as gatekeepers to extort small businesses and entrepreneurs trying to reach consumers. The results, tangible harms to businesses and communities, choking innovation, depressing business dynamism, and undermining job growth. These gatekeepers charge up to 30% just to allow businesses to transact with their own customers. As a comparison, credit card networks typically only charge around 3%. These lucrative fees aren't even levied on all companies equally. Big players like Uber and Amazon are exempt, showing these fees aren't about security or any other excuse, but about power. The fees are levied on those without the resources to fight them. Big tech gatekeeping also affects consumers. The money they spend to support Minnesota businesses instead is captured by monopolists and sent out of state. My organization meets developers all the time who are affected by these problems and want to speak out, but are afraid of retaliation. HF 1184 would protect them too, and incentivize developers to locate to Minnesota, knowing that it's a state that protects and fosters fair and open access to markets. We hope you support HF 1184, and we hope you'll allow Minnesota to revitalize its legacy as a tech powerhouse and become a national leader on a vital area of economic policy. Thank you.
Thank you. The next testifier is Sumit Sharma.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Sumit Sharma, and I'm a senior researcher at Consumer Reports. Founded in 1936, Consumer Reports is an independent, nonprofit, and nonpartisan organization that works with consumers to create a just and fair marketplace. CR surveys millions of Americans every year, reports extensively on the challenges they face. And, you know, we've always emphasized the fundamental importance of competition to ensure that a marketplace works for consumers. And that is what is that choice is missing in the App Store. So I'll make three brief points. First, app, as you've heard from others, Apple and Google have this gatekeeper power, which means these companies face very limited market pressure to change their ways. And in addition to the House Antitrust Subcommittee, there are many investigations taken abroad as well. For example, the Competition Market Authority in the UK, the European Commission and others. As a result of this, consumers are worse off. They may end up paying higher prices. We believe there's less innovation on these platforms because these gatekeepers decide who can innovate, who can't, and the way they innovate. And this act would change some of that by allowing alternative payment systems and alternative app distribution. And I would just end by saying that there is increasing bipartisan support for these measures. For example, the House Judiciary Committee, sorry, the Senate Judiciary Committee passed a bill that would do what this bill does and a couple of other things as well by a 20-2 majority. So, you know, there's increasing bipartisan support for this. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sharma. Next, we have Will Cunningham from the Match Group. Mr. Cunningham.
Hi, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for your bold leadership for holding this hearing and Rep. Wagermont for authoring and supporting legislation. You know, almost every day, almost everyone today uses a smartphone. It is often the first thing we see when we wake up, the last thing we see before we go to bed. We use it for any number of activities in our daily lives. And almost all these apps are hosted by, exclusively by two operating systems, Apple's iOS and Google's Android, who together have monopoly power over the app distribution market and mobile phones because they function as the gatekeeper to all mobile devices. This isn't just my opinion that Apple and Google are monopolies. Last year at a U.S. Senate hearing, Senator Klobuchar herself said, in every sense, the App Store is what we call walled garden. And by design, the App Store has a literal monopoly on the distribution of apps on Apple devices. For Match, App Store fees are one of our largest and fastest growing expenses. Our business, along with millions of other app-based businesses, cannot simply shift our users to web to the web or other devices because there is no real alternative to smartphones. If you don't have an app, your business might as well not exist. You know, we'll hear a number of specious claims from the other side, but I just ask you all to remember, you know, 84% of apps in the App Store, including the largest companies in the world, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Uber, pay just $99 a year, while Apple forces 16% of apps in the App Store, including Match Group, the dating apps, to use its in-app payment system processing for with an oppressive 30% tax. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, please examine the claims you hear from the other side. You will quickly see that these arguments are not real, but a veneer to defend the indefensible, a monopoly. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll now move to public testimony. The first public testifier is Jennifer Huddleston from NetChoice. Ms. Huddleston.
Thank you, Chairman Stevenson. My name is Jennifer Huddleston, and I'm policy counsel with NetChoice, a trade association whose members include many different tech companies, large players like Google and Amazon, as well as smaller players, many of whom you may or may not be aware of, like Etsy, Nextdoor, and other underlying technologies. I come today to oppose this legislation for a couple of key reasons. First, this legislation would pick winners and losers between big businesses and seeks to overturn a case that has already been decided by the court. Having failed in that case, now we see those who lost the case turning to state governments like yourselves to get a different outcome. Additionally, it seeks to interfere in contracts between these large players. But perhaps more concerningly is how this bill would harm Minnesotans. It would decrease the security present in many app stores, particularly around elements related to finances, and increase the possibility of fraud. It would take away features like Ask to Buy that parents can use to make sure their kids don't run up exorbitant bills for those in-app purchases, and it would likely raise the price by changing the underlying business model. Additionally, this would harm small businesses by decreasing the trust that they receive from the App Store by consumers knowing that these features are in place and changing the business model in a way that would likely raise costs. So for these reasons, I ask you to oppose HF 1184.
Thank you. The next testifier is Adam Kovacevic. A reminder that we have about 1 minute per person here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I lead Chamber of Progress. We're a center-left tech industry association that includes large companies like Apple and Google, as well as small tech companies. And I just want to convey one main point about this bill. It's not a priority for Minnesotans. 3 months ago, our organization conducted a survey of 800 Minnesota voters, had several noteworthy findings. First, we asked Ms. Soans which issues they wanted state leaders to most focus on. As you might expect, the top of that list included inflation, 59%, public safety, 55%, the economy, 51%. At the very bottom of the list was regulation of tech services. Just 18% of Minnesota voters called it a top priority. And then we asked which tech regulations in particular voters most wanted to see. The most popular choice was 45% of Minnesotans saying protection from online scams and malware. Next was combating misinformation online at 31%. But when it came to this issue, regulating app store rules, the issue ranked second to last. Just 4% of Minnesota voters called it important. So in other words, this bill is focusing on something that almost no Minnesota voters consider a problem. And it would make significant changes to the way that Minnesotans' iPhones would work, but they'd be changes for the worse. So we urge you to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. The next testifier is Caleb Williamson from the App Association. Mr.
Actually, Caleb is not here. It's Morgan Reed. I'm the president of the App Association and an actual software developer, as opposed to some of the other folks who've spoken. We represent about 5,000 small developers throughout the world, including in Minnesota. Our concerns with HF 1184 are really focused on some of the privacy and security issues. I'd like to talk about one of our Minnesota members, Vimos. Vimos is out of Minneapolis. They make an amazing product that helps bars and restaurants ensure that patrons are of age and helps them optimize inventory and helps bar staff prepare for each shift. The Vimos product actually allows them to verify identification, specifically driver's licenses, at the door. And customers can download the Vimos app to use contactless payment and rack up points and get discounts. As you can imagine, that's an enormous amount of important and personal data that Vimos is holding on to. And so they rely on a secure platform and a high level of trustworthiness to convince a restaurant owner that the product is safe to use. Unfortunately, the way that HF 1184 is currently written, it actually weakens the very security and privacy features that Vimos depends on and opens the door for sideloaded applications or other applications that may commit identity theft or be essentially fraudulent. And it requires the platforms to essentially make hardware and software APIs available to essentially anyone who walks up onto the app. So it makes it harder to kick bad apps off devices and really prohibits or limits the vetting process. We actually heard from the sponsor that that's what he wants to do, make it easier to put anything on and get rid of any vetting. But without vetting an app review, consumers are going to withdraw their support. So in short, we are very concerned about the way that it's structured. We're concerned that HF 1184 is going to really put a kibosh on the necessary privacy and security for some of the applications that our members depend on.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Carl Quackenbush. Mr. Quackenbush.
Hi. Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I'll use my 60 seconds to point out something that I don't think most of the committee understands. There's a significant defect in this legislation as written. All the conversation is about the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store, mobile phones, and the gatekeeper function that those companies serve. Our company distributes PC games on the PC platform. We don't do mobile games. We don't have a phone. We don't have a mobile operating system. This bill, as written, covers the entire PC software distribution industry, including us, and would make our business illegal in Minnesota. We have lots of Minnesota customers. We have lots of developers who use our system. The PC industry is very different. PC is an open platform. There's no gatekeeper. PC users can install whatever software they want on their computers from wherever they want to buy it, whenever they want it. This bill would cover the entire PC industry in a way that would decrease innovation, make it harder for users to find the games they want, and benefit a couple of companies who are the prime movers behind this bill, specifically Epic Games, one of our primary competitors to our Steam store. There's no reason to cover the American PC industry with this bill. No one's complaining about the things on that side that they are complaining about on the mobile side. And there's been virtually no mention whatsoever about this, the language in this bill that covers the American PC industry. You can speculate about why that is. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Tyler Dyers from TechNet. Mr. Dyers, 60 seconds, please.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We are opposed to this bill. I'm just going to focus on the payment processing part. Virtually every online marketplace charges a service fee. In the case of today's bill, the two mobile, you know, major mobile app stores that we've talked about charge between 50 and 30% for digital goods and only digital goods. So if you're a giant multi-billion dollar company, such as Match.com or Epic Games, there's a progressive fee structure similar to how Minnesota taxes income. These companies pay 30%. If you're a smaller company or a startup or under that $1 million per calendar year threshold, you pay 15%. These fees, they go to help developers reach billions of global users, provide for that infrastructure necessary to support regular malware scanning, prevent restricted content like hate speech and sexual content, prevent those spamming apps, and manage a safe and secure payment activity. And not only are these service fees in line with what other marketplaces charge, but developers earn a substantially higher share of total sales made through app stores than they would through brick and mortar channels. For example, video games, if they're sold in brick and mortar stores, the developers and publishers jointly collect up to an estimated 45% of the retail price. The remaining 55% goes to retail and wholesale margins.
Thank you, Mr.
Their distribution costs. Thank you.
And last, we have Sarah Richard from the Developers Alliance. Ms. Richard.
Thank you. I'm the policy counsel at Developers Alliance, a nonpartisan nonprofit association that advocates for software developers globally. In our many conversations with developers in Minnesota and elsewhere, we've heard three things worth sharing with you today. First, the vast majority of developers are neither asking for legislative help nor do they support this bill's goals. In fact, developers are acutely worried that the current global focus on punishing large tech companies is a threat to the ecosystem that enables their success. App stores provide developers tools, software kits, and APIs, necessary items to run their businesses. Small developer-led companies in particular benefit from the relationships they have with app stores and are concerned that disrupting this market will harm their businesses. Developers are well aware that these products and services don't come free, nor do they expect them to. Second, the developer community is large, diverse, and seldom speaks with a unified voice. Most developers do not see themselves as captive to the system. The few developers who have expressed discontent are admittedly independently extremely successful and wield their own lobby power. These companies are not reflective of the broader developer community. Most developers see this proposed legislation as reactionary to the ongoing litigation amongst two very successful tech companies, with their livelihoods being used as collateral. While we believe this committee has good intentions, we ask you to consider the fact that thousands of developers have come forward in recent weeks to inform our organization that they do not support it. Finally,
thank you, Ms. Richard.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry, but we do want to have a little time. There are two members asking for to have questions asked, and we have about 3 minutes left. So we will, if ever bring this bill back up, we will have more time for public testimony and questions. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like there's been a lot of concerns brought up about what this bill could do to potentially force platforms to host applications that aren't safe for users or could potentially scam users. So, Mr. Chair, my question for Representative Wolgamott is, you know, does this bill require any of the external payment systems or app stores to go through any type of security review or process to make sure that there's a minimum level of security for consumers?
Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Rasmussen. To your point that there have been testifiers saying that they're concerned that this legislation is going to force them to do something, that simply is not the case. And if you would look at the bill, it doesn't force the app developers to do anything. If they like working within the Apple and Google payment systems, they can continue to work within the Google and Apple payment systems. However, if they would like to work with applications such as or with payment systems such as Venmo or PayPal or use their airline miles. You know, let's let the marketplace decide this. So, again, we're not forcing anybody, any of the app developers to do anything here. We're giving them that choice to create the competition and, quite frankly, to be able to give them some leverage against having to pay the 30% app tax if they don't want to pay that tax. So just want to be careful about the words that you use, Representative Rasmussen. This legislation is not forcing anyone to do anything. To your question of the security of the payment systems, Mr. Chair, I think my testifier, Mr. Will Cunningham, could best get to that question about. You know, again, I know, for example, Apple and Google allow Uber to use a wide variety of different payment systems outside just the Apple and Google payments. It works just fine for Google. We think it can work just fine for these other developers, but Mr. Cunningham can shed more light on it.
Yeah, just
30 seconds.
Yeah, just very briefly, Representative Wogman did a great job explaining it already, but like, to my point, the 84% of apps already have alternative payment options. So this isn't sort of a brand new scheme or that we're enforcing anyone to implement or integrate. It already exists. We're just asking for equal treatment because they've arbitrarily decided that 16% of developers should pay this commission with no alternatives, while 84% don't have to.
Representative Rasmussen, any very, very brief follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to clarify, Representative Wogman, I was talking, you know, the bill potentially forces platforms, not app developers, to take unsafe apps, and I think those were the concerns that were raised by a multitude of testifiers today. And then, Mr. Chair, just to wrap up, not a question here, but this legislation, I think, is really about big business versus big business and interfering in, you know, lawsuits that are taking place between multi-billion-dollar corporations. And I would just point the committee and the public to even look at the exemption for special purpose app stores. You know, this bill is really targeted at specific businesses, and I just don't think it's appropriate for the state of Minnesota to be interfering in this. So thank you, Mr. Chair. And for respect of time, we'll hand it back.
Yeah, and thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Perhaps you and Representative Wolgamott can communicate offline about the answer to your question. Representative Lucero, any very brief question? I'm sorry about the time.
Thank you. I will not have a question, just a comment. Speaking about Representative Wolgamount's comment about watching the words you use, in his opening remarks, he said something to the effect of mobile users are locked down to two Play Stores. Well, I'm not sure what mobile phone he uses. I have an Android, so I just wanted to draw the bill office's attention. If you have an Android, go to Settings, Biometrics and Security, and there's an option there for Install Unknown Apps. That's the way to install apps outside of the Play Store. You're not locked down, and there is not a monopoly. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Representative Wolgamott, any very brief closing comments?
Thank you again, Mr. Chair, members, for taking time to hear this bill. Let's do what's right for Minnesota's consumers. Let's break Apple and Google's App Store monopolies, and let's put the small app developers and entrepreneurs and all of us who use mobile applications on an even playing field. Let's get this done. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. With that, I will renew my motion and lay over House File 1184 and adjourn the meeting. Thank you.